Welcome to Book Recos, Between the Pages.
I'm Jess.
And I'm Lauren.
And we're the pals behind Book Recos.
This is the podcast where we chat all things books and just about everything in between.
We are very excited for our first interview of 2024, where we are welcoming New York Times bestselling author Tia Williams.
You've heard us gush about some of her previous books before, including 7 Days in June and The Perfect Find. But today we are diving into her brand new book, A Love Song for Ricky Wilde. Tia, thank you so much for joining us today. I know it's so early where you are. We're really excited about this episode.
I am so thrilled to talk to you guys. Thank you for having me.
Oh, it's our absolute pleasure. So your latest book, A Love Song for Ricky Wilde, publishes in February. So please, can you kick things off by telling our listeners what it's all about?
Yeah. This is the fast version. It is about a free-spirited florist who's the black sheep of her family. She moves from the South to Harlem, New York, and opens her own flower shop. And there she meets an extremely mysterious musician and finds out that their lives are actually linked in very unique ways. And the whole love story takes place with the backdrop of Harlem Renaissance and modern Harlem. So there's a touch of magical realism. There's a little bit of leap year magic. There's some voodoo. It's very spicy. And I'm so excited for everyone to read it.
So like you've said, it's got a bit of everything. There's magic and mystery, scandal, steaminess, and friendship between lots of ages as well, which was so endearing to read. We loved it, and we'd love to know if you could share with us how this unique and very wonderful storyline came to you.
Well, so I'm a huge fan of big, high stakes love stories. The more fantastical, the better. And I always wanted to write a cursed romance and never really could figure out how. And then I swear this has never happened to me before. It will probably never happen again. But this story dropped into my head almost fully formed. I have insomnia. It was like 3 a.m. And all of these disparate elements sort of fell into my head. It was a haunted piano, the Harlem Renaissance, a musician with a past, a florist. I knew I wanted to do something with flowers. A fancy brownstone, and a mysterious elder landlady.
That is wild.
And so I was like, okay, 10 different super weird, elements. Now I have to, make a story out of them. And so that's where it came from. Yeah.
I love that. And I love that you mentioned that this has got some leap year magic, and it's a leap year. Was that a happy accident, or did you plan for it to be published in a leap year? Or did the leap year element come because you knew you had to publish it in 2024?
This was actually supposed to be published last summer, but I wasn't finished writing the book. It was always supposed to take place in February of 2024 because I needed it to be a leap year because, there's sort of that mythology that in February of leap years, the veil between this world and sort of the supernatural world is thin. And so weird things happen. So that's always where it took place. I didn't get the book in time. And then we were like, perfect. We can set the, we can release the book at the exact same time it's taking place. So it was actually a good thing.
I love that. And you've just reminded me actually that while I was reading it, I am quite a superstitious person. I get really scared of jinxing things. So I don't like to say that things are definitely happening until they do. And when I was reading your book and I saw that it was for February that hadn't happened yet, I was like, oh, oh my gosh, she's jinxing, what's gonna happen? So glad that it all worked out. But you know, this podcast is spoiler free, but we can say that there is an incredible twist. Neither of us saw it coming. We were obsessed with it, absolutely loved it. So without giving anything away, can you skirt around the subject and talk a little bit about how, perhaps if you can't talk too much about it, how you found writing a slightly fantastical element to a love story?
So I'd never done it before, first of all, and I was really nervous to even pitch this story to my agent and my editor. I was like, what the hell are they going to think? I mean, there's authors that do magical realism only, you know, like that's their focus and their skill set. Like, who do I think I am? But the thing is, like, this is my, it is not a horror book by any means, but I'm a huge horror fanatic. Like, my favorite authors are Stephen King and Anne Rice. I love weird shit. I love mysteries. I love, you know, surreal elements in books. And so I've read so much in, you know, I've read so many stories that have, you know, mystical elements that I actually felt comfortable writing it. And it's, even though the magical realism has a huge impact on the plot, it's very slight in the actual novel. Like, it's not overwhelming. It's not, you know, witches and warlocks. It's kind of, you know, simmering in the background. So I felt like it was something I could tackle. And the story was just so captivating to me, and it you know, married all of these elements that I'm such a huge fan of. I mean, Harlem Renaissance is, I'm a huge 1920s head. I love the Jazz Age. I love silent movies. I love the style. I love, you know, the music and the art and the literature that was coming out that time. I barely even had to do any research. So I felt so comfortable with the rest of, you know, the story. I was like, I can make this happen.
And you did. And, you know, it sounds like perhaps there was an element to it where you felt almost an imposter syndrome, perhaps. But something that I think you're amazing at writing is portraying Black excellence and having these strong Black female protagonists who are really strong-willed and independent. And that's no different in this book with Ricky Wilde. You've been able to share her journey in such a gripping way, as well as the history of Harlem. And as you say, it's Renaissance. And that wasn't something us as Brits were particularly familiar with. So for the rest of our listeners, are you able to touch on that a little bit?
Oh, yeah, that you're right. I didn't even think that. I feel like such a dumb American in this moment, because I'm like, everybody knows about the Harlem Renaissance. Why would you know about it?
No, do you know, I only know about it because of reading Colson Whitehead's Harlem Shuffle. And so, I mean, that's set in the 60s, but
yes,
that's kind of, yeah, my knowledge. It's definitely not a topic of history. So yeah, please.
Right. Yeah. Yeah. Colson Whitehead's Harlem Shuffle is so good. Yeah. It's something that I, you know, especially as a Black American, grew up knowing about, because it's, you know, it was such a shining moment in our culture where, you know, Black art was really on the forefront. And Black art is always happening, but in the 20s, it was, so there's this thing in America where it's like, when white people discover something that a disenfranchised culture is into, that legitimizes the culture. And in the 1920s, white people discovered Harlem. And right. So that put it on the forefront. Suddenly patrons were coming in with money to give these Black artists up in Harlem capital to make their music, write their, you know, write their movies, write their poems on a larger scale, make their, you know, fashions. And it sort of, you know, made what we were doing in Harlem global. You know, movie stars would suddenly, partying in Harlem was like the thing to do because there were so many cool cabarets and, you know, integrated nightclubs, which was a big deal back then. And so they would go up to Harlem and like party with the cool, you know, with the cool kids. It was just a really magical time. Prohibition was happening. So alcohol was illegal. And, you know, Harlem had the best liquor too. So you go up there, party, hear Duke Ellington, you know, and Billie Holiday and Josephine Baker perform at some, you know, speakeasy at 4 a.m. and wake up and go shopping in the coolest boutiques ever. See Langston Hughes, who's one of America's most important authors, like, you know, just chilling at a cafe. It was just a magical time. And I've been kind of obsessed with a lot of the players in Harlem for a long time. And I just and was really excited to figure out a way to work it into a modern story. Yeah. You know, without it being true historical fiction, like set in the 1920s, and, you know, working with flashbacks, it was really fun.
It's really well done as well. You feel the magic as a reader of what that time must have been like and why Ricky is drawn to this place. And hearing you speak about that time in Harlem, you know, back in the 20s, and your passion for it is similar to her, Ricky's passion for her flowers and her work and her belief in what she does. And so I just want to talk about Ricky a little bit because she's fantastic. And at the beginning of the novel, she's described as terminally curious, which I just think captures the chaos and curiosity of her character. And she's a mesmerizing lead in a mesmerizing story, just like so many of her books. So I wondered if you could chat a little bit about the inspiration for Ricky.
Yeah, so there's this thing, you know, in America about, you know, Black excellence. It's something we strive for. It's something we hold up as, you know, the goal. Are you living up to the idea of Black excellence? And it's a great thing, but it's also, you know, it's a great thing because it's in a country where we have been so disenfranchised. It feels good to remind ourselves, you know, that we're excellent. But the trap in it is, when Black excellence is defined as this very rigid, limiting thing. And Ricky comes from a really fancy family in the American South. They own a nationwide chain of funeral homes. They're socialites. She has 3 much older sisters who are just fabulous. They went to Ivy League colleges. They married well, they did everything right, they're inheriting the business, they're making their dad so proud. And Ricky is just, they are Black excellence, and Ricky is a Black sheep. She just doesn't have a passion for funeral homes. She isn't, you know, as well put together as her sisters. She has messy love affairs. She has no filter. She has a nose piercing and her passion is flowers. And so our family thinks she's nuts. And she strikes off on her own. And it's always been intriguing to me, the idea of, you know, a character who has the balls to march to the beat of their own drum, because to be 1,000% honest, I have more in common with her rigid sisters than I do with Ricky. I did everything right. I cross off all the boxes. I'm type A. I'm, you know, I would never just take a massive chance and try to do something I had no idea that I was already good at. And that's what she did. And I was so interested in a character like that.
And we have a lot of listeners on this podcast who are aspiring authors. And although this is, writing is something that has always been a part of your journey and your career, I guess changing careers from a background in journalism into moving into the publishing world was quite a big leap and quite a brave move as well. What led the change, if you wouldn't mind sharing?
Yeah, I mean, and I actually have to say, I didn't, it wasn't really a leap. So I've been doing the both of them, like dual pathing two careers, my whole career. So when I was growing up, I had two things that I was super passionate about. One was fashion magazines and the other was writing fiction. And I always knew there was never a question when I grew up, I was going to be a magazine editor, specifically a beauty editor. I love makeup and skincare and hair and all that stuff. And I was also going to write books. So when I graduated from university in 1997, I moved to New York. I moved to Brooklyn, New York. And I started working at Elle Magazine and worked in magazines and in the beauty world for the next 20 years. And I guess 2 or 3 years after that, I finally got the nerve. I guess I was about 25 to write my first novel. I had this terrible breakup. I was dating this very charming psychopath, which is what you do when you're 25. And the relationship was crazy. I was at, you guys have read or seen The Devil Wears Prada, right? Mm-hmm. Like that was the era that I was working in magazines. I had an insane boss who threw a bagel at my head. I should just say it was a really weird year, 25. And so I job, I broke up with the guy. I moved to Seville, Spain to go on sabbatical and teach English to third graders for a little bit. And while I was there, I sort of rewrote the story of my relationship with this guy so that it worked out in my favor. And he was like a good guy and we got together in the end. And, you know, I wrote it as therapy for myself. It didn't occur to me till I came back to New York and went back into magazines that I was like, oh, this is the book. This is my book. And so I sold it. It was my first novel, The Accidental Diva. And ever since then, I've always done both. It wasn't until last year that I quit my day job because I just could no longer be a beauty writer and an author and do the authoring at the level I really want.
Yeah. Well, firstly, props for turning your pain into art. Love that. And I wanted to ask, because we actually first came across your books, it was 7 days in June, and that was all thanks to Reese Witherspoon choosing it mm-hmm. as a Reese's Book Club pick. And so I wondered if that at all played a part in you being able to throw all your time and energy into being an author and having that as your sole full-time job. And then just generally, how was that? How did you find out that your book got chosen and all of the exciting stuff that led from that?
Yeah, that changed my life. Being a Reese's Book Club pick in, it was June 2021, absolutely changed my life. It, you know, introduced my book to a readership that may not have found it. It gave it an international audience. I mean, the people that are in Reese's Book Club and follow her picks are serious readers. You know, they mean business. They are all about the books that she picks every month. And it put me on a different level, I have to say. And so I no longer needed to work a day job, which was always my dream, but it's hard to get there. And it took me 24 years to get there. So if you have an audience of authors, I just want to say it's tough to get to this place. And most writers I know have another job. Yeah. But yeah, it was so exciting. I found out a couple of months before she announced.
Okay.
And it's always top secret. You cannot tell a soul, because in Reese's book club, there's a whole mystery around her unveiling who the author's going to be. And so no one knew, but my husband. It was so hard. I do not keep secrets well. This one I kept well because I was so scared. And it's funny, like you can't, the publisher can't even tell, you know, retailers.
Oh, wow.
So it's this whole game of the retailers, when your book is about to come out, they'll be like, oh, and did any of the celebrity book clubs pick this book? And your publisher's like, maybe we don't know which one though, you know.
Yeah.
Like it's like this veiled conversation, because you really can't say anything. Yeah.
That's hilarious. And side note, whilst we're talking of 7 days in June, we loved the little Easter eggs you planted throughout the book, which sort of peppered Eva Mercy's vampire erotica novels throughout. And then obviously she has a bit of a role in the book as well. So thank you for that. We loved that. And if that wasn't incredible enough, having a Reese's Book Club pick for 7 days in June, obviously Perfect Find, which we also adored, has been optioned by Netflix. And we gushed about this book on the podcast before, but would you mind just recapping for our listeners what it's about, if they haven't already watched the film with Gabrielle Union and Gina Torres as the leading ladies?
Yeah, so The Perfect Find was about a 40-year-old woman who worked, who was a fashion editor for a long time, and she was kind of an it girl in New York, and suddenly the rug gets pulled out from under her. Her longtime love and fiance dumps her. She loses her job. She loses her home. She has a nervous breakdown, and she moves home to live with her mom in Virginia. When she finally pulls herself together, she realizes she needs to get a job and get on with her life. And so she goes back to New York to work for her frenemy from the 90s, this evil woman named Darcy Vail. And she's working at her online fashion publication. And once she's there, she accidentally falls madly in love with a camera guy she's assigned to film a YouTube series with, a fashion YouTube series. And the twist is that he's half her age. Mm-hmm. And then the twist on top of that is that he's the son of her boss, the frenemy. So yeah, that's what it's about.
It's amazing. And did you play any involvement in the production of the film at all?
I didn't. I was too scared. You know, there's several ways this can go when your book gets adapted for film or TV. You can be an executive producer so that you have, you know, some say in the production. You can write you can be the screenwriter so that you can, you know, be involved in the actual writing of it. Or you can sit it out. And it's kind of a thing of, you know, here's my baby, be good to her. I was a single mom at the time, and I had a huge career writing beauty copy at Estee Lauder companies. And I was also working on 7 days. So I didn't really have anything to do with the movie, but I love how it turned out and their interpretation of the story. It was really fun.
Yeah, it is really fun. That is what, and I felt that when I read the book, and then also when I watched it, it has the same vibes. I'm really glad they pulled that off on your behalf.
Yes, me too.
And 7 days in June is being adapted into a series too, if we've read correctly. When is that out?
So that we don't have a date yet. We're still at the beginning stages. We were just getting going when the huge writer's strike happened.
Oh, of course.
It was a writer's strike and an actor's strike. So we were, you know, Hollywood was at a complete standstill for a long time. So now we're just now getting back into production. So I don't have a date yet or any talent that's attached to it confirmed yet that I can announce, but I'll let you know when we have some details. But yeah, it's going to be a series, a limited 8-episode series. So I'm super excited. I cannot believe it's happening. Yeah, and that amazing. One, I'll be an executive producer. So
amazing. That will work so well as a series opposed to a film, I think. That would be
brilliant. There's with the back and forth, you know, the time switches with even Shane, and you know, it's a complicated story. So I love that we're giving it the space to breathe over 8 episodes.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, because a film, I guess you must have to cut so much because a film can only be so long. Although it seems like films are getting longer and longer these days.
Oh my God. 3 hours plus these days.
Do you ever write books with celebrities in mind to play them? Or whether it's, you know, you're not writing it to adapt, but you're creating a character and you're like, yeah, this person kind of looks like so-and-so. Do you ever do that?
Well, I don't usually do that. But what is so weird is that I did that with The Perfect Find. Like, I was having a really tough time towards the middle of writing it, trying to figure out what the second half was going to be about. I have this friend who's a life coach. I'm not a particularly spiritual person or very new agey or anything like that. And so manifestation and I've never really done that. But I have this friend who's a life coach, and he was like, look, you need to make a vision board. And I don't mean on Pinterest, I mean an actual physical vision board that you cut shit out of a magazine, you write things with your own hand, you make a collage, like, you know. And so he was like, there's so much power in that, like, just try it, you know, you have nothing to lose, you don't believe in it anyway. So I did it. I went and got like a big poster board, and I'm going through my magazines and cutting them up. And so on the vision board, I saw Jenna, the protagonist of The Perfect Find, as Gabrielle Union.
Wow.
The guy was Michael B. Jordan, which was appropriate. Because he was really young back then. It was like 10 years ago. So he was like 22 or something like that. By the time we did the movie, it didn't make sense because, you know, real grown up. But yeah, so the cover obviously had not been done yet. I was only halfway through the manuscript, but the poster board was yellow and the cover of the
program, oh my God.
It's wild. Yeah. Like all these things that I put on the vision board actually came true, which is absolutely bizarre.
Love that. But
yeah, that's really the only time I ever thought of, you know, a real actor, like in, you know, being one of my characters. Yeah.
Moral of the story, be careful what you put in your vision board.
True.
Yeah. Well, that's fascinating. It's making me want to make vision boards for everything in my life now. And I'm probably a bit more like you and not, you know, don't believe in it as much, but maybe I should. And we could chew your ear off all day and find out more and more of these amazing things that you've got to reveal. But I'm conscious that it's very early where you are and you might want a coffee. But before we let you go, please can we ask you to leave a book reco of your own for our readers? So this can be a book that you've loved for a really long time, or it could be something new that you've recently read.
Does it have to be romance?
No, anything.
Because okay, let me rewind. I have a bunch of romance recs, but the most recent book I read that I loved was called The Only Good Indian. And it's horror, which takes place on a Native American reservation. And I don't know if you guys are familiar with It by Stephen King. But it's about a group of friends on that live on a reservation, or something really weird happened to them when they were kids. Now they're all haunted. And so the book sort of takes place in modern day times, where you see how the haunting affects each one of these friends. Oh my God. It is so good. It's so emotional. It's funny. It's like heartwarming. I cried at the end. There's, it's kind of like a folk horror mythology kind of a tale. If you're into that kind of thing, you've got to pick it up. It won all these awards. It's incredible.
Adding that to my own list, I think. Yeah. And we'll put it in the show notes for listeners as well. Thank you so much, Tia. Everyone, go ahead and pre-order A Love Song for Ricky Wilde, which is out in February. And Tia, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you. I had a blast. I really appreciate you guys reaching out to me. This was so fun.
Much for listening. If you enjoyed today's episode, like, subscribe, leave a rating and review. It costs you nothing, but it genuinely means the world to us.
And don't forget to share our podcast with your reading buddy, because they might like to listen as well. And if you don't already, then follow us on Instagram at bookrecos for, funnily enough, more book recommendations.
See you next week.
We'll be here.